Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, March 15, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the EPA's anticipated attempt to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our experts, two experts today, of about 6 to 8 minutes, followed by your questions. Our first expert, William J. Hahn, is author of a Federalist Society white paper on this topic. A link to that paper was provided to you in the notice of this call and is, of course, available on the Federalist Society website. He'll lead us off with 6 to 8 minutes of comments. He'll be followed by Mark Delaquil, who is a partner at the Baker & Hostetler law firm, is a partner at the Baker & Hostetler law firm here in D.C., where he has represented Fortune 500 companies, states, trade associations, amici curiae groups, and public interest groups in regulatory proceedings, complex federal litigation, and appellate proceedings. Their full bios are also available on our website. So with that, Mr. Hahn, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. For roughly two decades, the U.S. Congress has possessed a bipartisan consensus on the regulation of greenhouse gases from industrial sources. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Both Democrats and Republicans have cited a variety of practical problems that would prevent the Environmental Protection Agency from using the Clean Air Act, the awkward basis for current greenhouse gas regulation, to regulate emissions from existing stationary sources of energy. Nevertheless, President Obama maintains that America cannot resist this transition, and the EPA is thus expected to take a step that many believe has not merely prudential, but also legal problems. To reinterpret Section 111D, a provision of the Clean Air Act that was previously limited to existing source emissions of discrete and relatively rare substances, to reach much more commonplace greenhouse gas emissions. Since the Supreme Court's 2007 decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, the EPA has begun regulating greenhouse gases under various provisions in the Act. Outside environmental groups have taken advantage of the new uncertainty in how far the EPA could go in regulating greenhouse gases by suing the agency in 2008. The EPA settled that case in 2010, promising regulation that would be different from past actions, meaning that they would mandate emission reductions from existing stationary sources of greenhouse gases, the very subject that has bedeviled Congress for years. Without any new authority from Congress, the EPA is undertaking this new regulatory mission. Now, the EPA, for its part, denies that its interpretation is a stretch, asserting in a 2008 advance notice of proposed rulemaking that cap and trade is a permissible form of 111D regulation. However, there are very strong arguments that the EPA's current interpretation of Section 111D is at odds with the controlling statutory language and dilutes that language to fit the agency's regulatory aims. In order to best appreciate these arguments, it's necessary to understand how Congress amended Section 111D of the Clean Air Act in 1990 and the implications those amendments possess in terms of the EPA's authority here. Under the version of Section 111D enacted within the Clean Air Act of 1970, the EPA is precluded from using the 111D program to set standards for pollutants that are already regulated under either Section 108 of the Act, which covers criteria pollutants, or Section 112, the list of hazardous air pollutants. In 1990, Congress returned to amend the Clean Air Act, with the House and Senate each making an amendment affecting the scope of 111D regulation. The House amendment altered the focus of the limitations on the EPA's authority here. From its creation in 1970 until its amendment in 1990, Section 111D spoke only in terms of pollutants whose emissions from existing sources fell outside the scope of 111D. In other words, those pollutants already subject to regulation under Sections 108 and 112. The House amendment, as reflected in the current U.S. Code, expands the carve-out from 111D regulatory authority to include sources, in essence, those sources regulated under Section 112. On its face, therefore, Section 111D, as reflected in the current U.S. Code, does not provide the EPA with authority to establish performance standards for greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants, since that source category is regulated under Section 112 of the Act. The Senate amendment maintained Section 111B's pre-existing limitation on the duplicative regulation of pollutants that are regulated under Section 112 by striking Section 111B1's reference to the former Section 112B1A and replacing it with that section's current equivalent. The view reflected in the comments to this bill that was signed by President George H.W. Bush in 1990 and the subsequent codifier's notes suggests a view that's common today among many commentators, that the House and Senate amendments are duplicative. The question then becomes, how do you properly interpret those amendments? Well, a fundamental principle of statutory interpretation is that courts should, to the extent possible, give effect to a law in its entirety. Supplementing this principle is another. Statutes should be construed according to the plain meaning of their text where that meaning is unambiguous. This reading evinces that the two amendments to Section 111D place different limitations on the scope of the EPA's authority. In enacting the House amendment, Congress added a limitation on the reach of 111D. Where a category of sources is being regulated under Section 112, 111D cannot be used to impose additional performance standards on that source category. In contrast, in enacting the Senate amendment, Congress intended to maintain the pre-1990 prohibition on using 111D to regulate emissions from existing sources of those substances regulated as hazardous pollutants under 112. So in accordance with this reading of 111D, the EPA lacks authority to establish standards of performance for existing sources of air pollutants, which are included on a list published under either Section 108 or 112, a substance-focused limitation, this is the Senate amendment, or which are emitted from source categories regulated under Section 112. This is a source-focused limitation and is the House amendment. Since power plants are regulated under Section 112, therefore, Section 111D does not provide the EPA with authority to establish performance standards for greenhouse gas emissions therefrom. Now, previously, the EPA offered its own attempt to harmonize the Senate and House amendments so as to further cap-and-trade regulation under Section 111D. But the EPA's interpretation weakens both those amendments and therefore betrays Congress's intent in enacting them. The EPA's construction gives no effect to the House amendment because the EPA's reading simply reconfirms the Act's original prohibition of hazardous air pollutants under Section 111D. The agency's construction also weakens the Senate amendment through a source category limitation that the EPA imports onto the Senate amendment from the House amendment. In other words, the EPA offered a construction here that neither retains the Senate or House amendment limitations, but shrinks them. This construction, thus, cannot be permissible under either classic statutory construction canons or the standard deference afforded to administrative agencies. With that, I turn it over to Mark.
Well, thanks for your excellent explanation of the problems that EPA's proposal or anticipated proposal to regulate greenhouse gases under Clean Air Act Section 111D presents. I just want to cover three topics here. And first, why is this a new problem? Second, why is this important? And third, what are the broader implications for the administrative state? First, why is this a new issue? We could have been on this call 10 years ago when EPA was first considering whether or not it should be regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, and could be looking at this saying almost the same thing. Congress has got an old statute. Numerous other laws have been passed touching on greenhouse gases, authorizing the technologies that would be regulated. Why is this a new issue? And didn't the Supreme Court decide this in 2007 in Massachusetts versus EPA? And I think the answer here is that Massachusetts EPA answered only a simple threshold question. Can greenhouse gases be regulated under the Clean Air Act? The court held that greenhouse gases were air pollutants and could be regulated under specific programs, as appropriate under specific programs, but it didn't say what those programs were, whether EPA had to regulate under all of the programs. It basically said that EPA had discretion to address this issue piecemeal under the Act. That doesn't mean that Section 111 is the appropriate vehicle for doing so. And since Massachusetts versus EPA, we've seen regulation on the automobile side in the form of fuel economy standards. We've seen it with new source standards. You know, if you want to build a new industrial facility, you may have to account for your greenhouse gas emissions in some way, but you don't necessarily have to reduce emissions just by the fact of operating. And I think that's a major distinction. It's one thing to take into account these issues when you're planning for a new facility or when you're going to expand an existing facility potentially, but it's another to have to take them into account simply by operating. It raises a host of questions like, are you able or is EPA able to implement a cap and trade program? And as Will mentioned, Congress has been completely unable or unwilling, or wisely or unwisely, to address that topic. But you could get that under the Act. So I think that this is a new problem, and it's an important problem. The way EPA has traditionally regulated stationary source, you know, major industrial facility emissions, is through the ambient air quality program. EPA doesn't want to do ambient air quality standards in this situation because it threatens a permanent non-attainment status for the United States with significant economic implications. And 111D is a source of authority it believes could potentially avoid those issues. Second is trading programs. You know, could EPA use a trading program as it had suggested it can under the Mercury Rule? Obviously, that has major economic implications, major environmental implications for the country. And the third thing I'd like to discuss is what are the issues that are broader than just the Clean Air Act, but that implicate, you know, fundamental questions of administrative governance in the United States. You know, regardless of what one thinks of the merits of regulating greenhouse gases, I think we can all agree that the question of whether or not you regulate them is controversial. There's no consensus. And I think that we could also agree that when Congress enacted Section 111D as part of the 1970 Clean Air Act amendments and revised it again in 1990, that it didn't envision it being a cap-and-trade program. So the question is, when you have a statute like the Clean Air Act that contains a very broad delegation of discretion, you know, is it consistent with our constitutional system of governance for a vague and broad statute from the 1970s to be the primary vehicle for addressing a major social problem today just because of the statute's protean and uncertain nature? I would posit that our constitutional structure contains a very strong preference for decisions that are legislative in nature to be made by the Congress, which is vested with the legislative authority, and to be vetted through a process of bicameralism and presentment to ensure that the separation of powers are satisfied. And while delegation of lawmaking authority is not allowed, Congress has always been able to delegate discretion. But again, when you have a very old and very vague statute, even if there is an intelligible principle, is this really the type of system and really the type of issue where deference is appropriate? The theoretical underpinnings of Chevron deference are that statutory ambiguity is a delegation of discretion from Congress to the agency. And, you know, and the genius of Chevron is that when you consider that delegation, that the agency receives the authority because it's politically accountable. It's part of the executive branch. Its principal officers are appointed in accordance with the Constitution. And because Congress is essentially giving away that authority to that discretion to the agency, that it prevents Congress from using these schemes to aggrandize its own power. But a different way to look at this issue and to look at these separation of powers questions is along the lines that the Supreme Court recently did in Free Enterprise Fund, where the court was concerned about the separation of powers maintaining political accountability. Here, I think you could make a strong case that the political accountability really lies in, you know, a very old congressional enactment. And if the norms that existed in the 1980s when Chevron were passed about Congress's ability to change those enactments no longer hold true, whether or not Congress, you know, by enacting these, has essentially ossified the authority in a way that is difficult to change, is a big concern from my perspective. I don't claim to have all the answers on this issue. It's certainly, you know, one way to address this could be the non-delegation doctrine. The court's limited its scope and, in fact, has rejected non-delegation challenges to the Clean Air Act in the past. So that may not be the way. But I think that the question of statutory obsolescence and the ability of agencies to assert broad powers in light of that obsolescence is a very real one and is a very real one presented by this case. Dean, I'm going to turn the floor over to you for any questions that you or the audience has.
Thank you. Terrific. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, you're going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And as is our habit, let me begin by giving you a programming update. We've got three Teleforum conference calls so far scheduled for next week. Arizona versus Intertribal Council is a U.S. Supreme Court case that's going to be argued on Monday. Our expert, Eric Jaffe, is going to attend oral argument and then participate in a Teleforum conference call at 2 p.m. on Monday, Eastern Time, at this same number. That case concerns the interaction of federal law and Arizona's voter ID law. It's been much in the press, so you're probably familiar with it. Then on Wednesday, next Wednesday, our call is going to feature a recap of a recently decided and also very important Seventh Circuit Second Amendment case. That's the case with an opinion by Judge Posner, in which he struck down for a three-judge panel an Illinois statewide ban on carry permits. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. You've probably seen news articles circulating even today and yesterday describing a disagreement between the Illinois governor and the Illinois Attorney General about whether or not to seek U.S. Supreme Court review now that the Seventh Circuit recently denied en banc review. And then on Thursday next week, also at 2 o'clock, sounds like all our calls are going to be at 2 o'clock next week. On Thursday, we're going to continue our NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, series of Teleforum conference calls with a call looking at the NLRB's posting regulations. That's Thursday at 2 o'clock. Again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have one caller with a question. After that, our lines are open. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. While we may recognize that there are limits to what we can do about Congress or the courts, what is within our control is the arguments we make in pursuing cases before the courts. And we're not going to get something if we don't ask for it. And we're not going to roll back bad precedents unless we demand that they be rolled back. And I submit that, and I ask for your comment on whether or not what we really need to be doing is to vigorously and relentlessly demand rolling back all the bad precedents on commerce and the necessary and proper clause and all the other clauses that have been misinterpreted in the Constitution, all the way back to McKellar v. Maryland, to do so regardless of how irritated it might make the judges. To demand until there is a political crisis that requires the judges either be replaced or amendments to the Constitution.
Who wants to respond to that?
I'll go first, Dean, if Mark doesn't mind. This is Will speaking. I don't think that's particularly necessary with this particular issue. As Mark pointed out in his comments with regard to Massachusetts versus EPA, which the Supreme Court decided about five, six years ago, this is what we're talking about here is even novel and kind of potentially a step beyond, even what the court has dealt with. So when you're dealing with an issue that's unprecedented, I don't think it's necessary to kind of go back and re-question everything for whatever merits re-questioning those things may have. It's simply not necessary to make the point that we want to make here, that this is really a step beyond the authority that the EPA has in its attempt to try and construe 111D here.
Thanks, Will. And I agree with you that the question here could really, be used to stem the bleeding on this issue and to prevent it, the Supreme Court's jurisprudence from going either further in the wrong direction. To your broader point about raising these issues in multiple cases and sustaining an aggressive campaign against bad judicial decisions in the past, I think it's an interesting one. But I think the way that the other side has won these decisions has in general been through strategically advancing cases that present the best arguments. In cases with bad facts to make bad law, they were careful in choosing them, and I think that we ought to be careful in choosing the cases where we ask for these issues to be revisited in as well. Although I certainly can understand the frustration with the continued perpetuation of bad decisions.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone at this line. At this point, our lines are completely open. Let me ask a question. You've both, I think, suggested that or recognized that there's the problem we're discussing here or you're laying out here hasn't yet occurred. That is, the EPA has not regulated in this area. This is about potential or anticipated regulations in this area. How certain is it that the EPA will proceed? And if so, how soon will that happen? How do we know this? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, maybe this is Mark, and I'll take the first crack at this question. Will mentioned in his remarks that in 2010, EPA entered into a settlement agreement with a group of states and environmental groups that required it to propose performance standards from existing coal-fired power plants and existing petroleum refineries under Section 111D. This was one of the much maligned sue and settlements that have occurred over the last 5 years with the government. And as a result, if EPA were to fail to propose these standards, then there would be a potential judicial recourse against the agency. They would be in violation of their agreement. I think it may also be appropriate to consider some of the broader implications of these sue and settle agreements, but I'll leave that open to the floor about whether there's interest in that. Will?
I think that's right. The EPA certainly does feel that it has the color of authority, thanks to its 2010 settlement, to begin working on this issue. But there are also kind of other issues going on within the policy and policymaking and political process that's suggesting that this is really coming around the pike. It was just a few weeks ago at the beginning of this month that President Obama picked a new EPA chief to replace Lisa Jackson. He picked Ms. McCarthy. So that is also kind of a signal that the EPA will likely be a little bit more aggressive in this area. And certainly the EPA has thought about this issue of using 111D in cap and trade for some time. As I mentioned earlier, they've asserted, at least in passing, in a 2008 advance notice of proposed rulemaking that this authority might exist, and that was, you know, roughly 5 years ago. So this has been on the EPA's radar for some time. Frankly, I think it's really just a question of when the politics and the policy all kind of line up and make this possible. And it seems like we're getting closer to that period.
You've both, I think, mentioned, well, by the way, if you have a question for either of our experts, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. As I say that, our lines are open. You both mentioned the 2010 settlement agreement. I think one of you, I think it was Mark Delacroix, mentioned it in the settle and sue context. Maybe I wonder if you want to say more about that, the agreement that EPA entered into with various environmental groups and states that brought the 2008 lawsuit does provide the EPA with justification to craft a cap-and-trade system for existing power plants, and what kind of separation of powers concerns arise under that, and who's policing these settlements? I mean, presumably these were, I hear about these all the time, settlements that are happening presumably supervised by courts. Are they widely recognized to be sue and settle, or, you know, some type of collusion behind the scenes?
Well, so this is Will. I'll take a first stab at that. And in terms of that, the settlement itself, so as I mentioned at the beginning of my comments, after Massachusetts versus EPA, the EPA began entertaining greenhouse gas regulation in a variety of different ways, particularly performance standards for automobiles stand out, as well as in some other ways involving pre-construction permits. But there was a sense of uncertainty as to how far the EPA could really go with greenhouse gas regulation, because for the past 35 years or so under the Clean Air Act, this type of regulation really hadn't been used toward greenhouse gases. This was somewhat novel. So the uncertainty prompted the lawsuit. And this was in 2008. And when the EPA settled the case in 2010, it ultimately agreed that it would determine cost-effective control strategies for determining greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, in other words, stationary energy sources. And unlike other regulatory actions, you know, Dean, you mentioned the implications of sue and settle, this settlement agreement was not subject to any kind of public notice or comment. There's no record showing that the agency's leadership seriously analyzed its legal authority to carry out the settlement. And as you know, I mentioned before, I'm of the view, as mentioned in this paper, that the EPA simply does not possess the authority under the Clean Air Act in Section 111D and the amendments of 1990 to go ahead with this type of regulation. So what that means, as far as the settlement's concerned, is that the EPA was bargaining with power it didn't have. It was making an agreement on authority it couldn't actually deliver. And so what I see happening, and I think Mark might be able to kind of explain this in some more depth, is you have the EPA very likely using the color of one branch's authority, the judiciary, to do something that another branch, legislature, never gave it the authority to do, in order to inflate the power of its own branch, the executive. That's a real separation of powers problem from where I sit, but I think Mark might be able to add some more to this.
Sure. Thanks, Will. And, you know, Dean, you know, regardless of whether there's collusion in these settlements, I think they present a significant separation of powers concern. You know, under our constitutional system, the executive is charged with faithfully executing the laws, and one of the most important parts of faithfully executing the laws is the type of discretion about which policies to pursue. You know, how will you do that? You know, will you favor, you know, enforcing law X because that's how you'll get the greatest public benefit? And if the public disagrees, they can, you know, vote in the next election for an administration that will have different priorities. When you sue and settle, you effectively bind both your discretion and the discretion of future executive branches about how to exercise their authority. In this case, the settlement was in 2010, and we have the same administration in 2013, and it may not have the same practical effect. But from a constitutional perspective, had there been a new administration that had been hamstrung by this, it would present a significant constitutional issue. I think it also undermines the public accountability in the separation of powers. I mentioned that in my opening remarks, but by entering into a settlement agreement or a consent decree, EPA has effectively used the judicial power to shield itself from any criticism about whether or not this is how it should be exercising its authority. It's we're legally required, the court's requiring us. And I think that that's not really how the system was intended to operate.
Well, and this is Dean Reuter again. I suppose my question also goes to who's superintending these settlements, who's supervising these. It reminds me a little bit of class action litigation where some folks claim that plaintiff's attorneys are interested in getting the highest possible attorney's fees. The defendants are just interested in settling the case at the lowest possible cost, even if the fees are higher relative to the benefits to the defendants, or to the plaintiffs rather, the plaintiff class members, and the court's interested in getting the case off the docket. In that process, I understand there can be interveners or objectors. Is there any way for third parties to enter on the front end of these sue and settlement cases? If not, are the courts responsible for making sure that the EPA is settling within the confines of its authority?
I think, Dean, this is Mark. I'll answer this. Generally speaking, industry groups often seek to intervene in settlements. Intervention in a lawsuit that seeks to force EPA to do something is judged under the same standards as intervention in any other lawsuit under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That said, there's been a significant split in the courts about whether or not groups that would be affected by a rule are entitled to intervene. And I believe this issue is currently under consideration by the D.C. Circuit in a case where the Utility Water Act group sought to intervene in a power plant effluent limitations guideline case. It's an important case. I don't believe it's been decided yet. It might be worthy of its own teleform in the future. On the back end, the Clean Air Act requires EPA to take public notice on the consent decrees. They publish them in the Federal Register, publish their availability in the Federal Register, and interested parties can comment. That's how it's supposed to work. As a practical matter, once there's a consent decree reached, it's almost always a fait accompli that an agency will seek it to be entered after the end of the public comment period. So, there are some mechanisms for intervention at the front end or for a public comment at the back end, and certainly they're worth taking advantage of, although I think people might give you mixed views about how effective they really are.
We do have one more audience question at this point. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another caller question.
Hi, this is Brian Mannix. I haven't seen the settlement, so I can't comment on that, but in full disclosure, I should say I was the associate administrator of EPA when Mass v. EPA was handed down, and I'd remind everybody that we lost that case, and Massachusetts won. I suspect that's the decision that EPA would identify as its source of authority and not the settlement agreement. But my question relates to how you'd interpret the rest of the Act. Assuming you're correct that Section 111 doesn't give EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gases, it seems to me there are two ways to look at the Act as a whole then, without overturning Mass v. EPA. One is that EPA has authority to regulate mobile sources, maybe has authority to regulate new sources, but does not have any authority to regulate this pollutant from existing sources. And that seems to me an implausible construction of the act as a whole. The second would be that EPA does not have the authority to regulate under 111, but does have the authority under 108 or 112. And I wonder, which of those interpretations of the act do you find more likely to be right? And does either 108 or 112 strike you as a more plausible way of regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act than 111?
This is Will. I'll take a first stab at it. So I think actually maybe one of the wiser things to do here might be to sort of wait for Congress to revisit the issue of greenhouse gas regulation. As I mentioned at the beginning of my comments, it is kind of awkward to use certain portions of the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases, particularly 111D, which goes to more kind of discrete and rare substances as opposed to something like greenhouse gas. And also, too, if you think about what the point of the House amendment in 1990 was, and the Senate amendment as well, you see, I think, that it kind of caused some problems that Congress didn't want to cause if all of a sudden you start reading into 111D the authority to reach greenhouse gases on existing stationary sources of energy. You know, it's possible maybe that you revisit some of the issues around delisting that were discussed a few years ago with the D.C. Circuit, although you'd have to follow the proper procedure so it's not vacated on procedural grounds. But you know, maybe that's a way to reach it. But it doesn't make sense, I think, to regulate greenhouse gas through some kind of, you know, more approach that recognizes it as some kind of toxic gas, because that just wouldn't live up to the characteristics of greenhouse gas. So probably the best answer is, I think, for Congress to revisit this and to actually come up with a program that goes to the democratic process, is subject to, you know, the review from stakeholders, and doesn't involve so much contortion of a statute.
Mark? Thanks, Will. And I think the caller and the questioner has brought up an important point. You're the agency. The Supreme Court did decide in Massachusetts versus EPA that greenhouse gases are an air pollutant as defined in Section 302 of the Act. After that decision, and even before that decision, the EPA was faced with numerous petitions for action under different regulatory programs. So from the agency's perspective, what to do? An important question. I don't think that the question is the same binary choice that the questioner posed. I think the right answer is you take each individual program under the Act and you see, do greenhouse gases fit under that program? In the Title II program, the Light Duty Motor Vehicle program, EPA went and they said, well, under Section 202, we are going to make a positive endangerment determination, and they fit. That decision was upheld by the D.C. Circuit several months ago. But then you also go to Section 111. You look at Section 111B, New Source Performance Standards. Do greenhouse gases fit there? EPA published a proposal indicating that they believe that they do. While I certainly disagree with certain aspects of the proposal and the level of the proposed standard, I think the underlying question of whether or not you can regulate them there is an important one, and EPA has a reasonable position that you can. You go to 111D, and in light of the prohibition in the Act against regulating a source category that's regulated as a source category under the Section 112 Air Toxics Program, you look and you say, no, that's not an appropriate vehicle for regulation. The questioner brought up two other sections of the Act, 108 and 112. 108 is the National Ambient Air Quality Standards Program. I mentioned that briefly in my opening remarks. There are numerous problems with regulating a substance that's primarily present in the upper atmosphere at uniform concentrations and is caused by sources, you know, throughout the globe rather than the localized pollution impacts that I think 108, Section 108 envisions. I think there's a strong textual and a strong structural argument under the Act that that's not an appropriate vehicle for regulating greenhouse gases. The questioner also mentions Section 112 of the Act, which deals with air toxics or hazardous air pollutants, as they're sometimes called. You read the definition in Section 112B of the Act. I think a strong argument is that that doesn't fit greenhouse gases either, given that, you know, the focus on such effects as, you know, carcinogenic, mutagenic, teratogenic, and neurotoxic effects on the public health side envision a direct exposure route that you don't get with greenhouse gases. A pollutant could also potentially be listed under 112 for adverse environmental effects, but I also think there it's reasonable to conclude that the adverse environmental effects would actually have to be caused by exposure or deposition rather than by climatic changes. So I think that you have to consider every program individually, and that the goal is not even necessarily, you know, to make sure that there's regulation of everything under one provision, regulation of all sources or all existing sources under one provision, but to see whether or not regulation under each individual program in the Act makes sense. So that would be my answer.
We've got another audience member question. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next audience member.
Hi. First of all, thank you for, as always, an excellent Federalist Society presentation. This may be a bizarre question out of left field, but perhaps the right approach would be, if you can't beat them, join them. Would it be possible to sue the EPA for not regulating human production of carbon dioxide and thereby force them, Congress, to deal with the issue by bringing it to its insane logical conclusion?
Who wants to respond to that?
I'll respond to that. This is Mark. I certainly, you know, think that, you know, as Will mentioned before and as you mentioned, that congressional action in this area is appropriate, whether it's congressional action to regulate or whether it's congressional action to say that the Clean Air Act isn't the appropriate vehicle for regulation. And while I certainly, you know, would be tempted to attempt to hoist the agency on its own petard, I think, as I mentioned earlier, you'd have to find a specific program under the Act where humans would fall. I'm not sure that I can think of any specific programs that would be appropriate in that instance.
I'm with Mark, if anyone's curious.
Will Hahn, do you have anything to add there?
I was just going to say I'm with Mark.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Looks like we – let me make one final call for questions. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And let me remind folks of our next Teleforum conference call, which is Monday at 2 p.m., and we'll be talking about the Arizona voter ID call. We do have another question, so let's go to our next caller.
Hey, this is Rod Sullivan, Florida Coastal. Quick question, carbon taxes and cap and trade. Can the EPA enact either or both of these constitutionally without any action by Congress? Or is this a tax that's prohibited for an agency to enact under the Constitution?
Well, so are you speaking about cap and trade and carbon taxes separately?
Well, no, I consider
okay.
them to both be different
okay.
devices for accomplishing the same result.
Okay. Well, so, you know, just to give you a sense as to how this would work, if the EPA wanted to try and go ahead with regulating and implementing a cap-and-trade scheme through 111D, they would use the idea of state-based implementation plans. So what the EPA would do is they would say that there's been sort of a finding about the use of regulating greenhouse gas emissions, and states would be able to come up with a state-based implementation plan to regulate them, and cap and trade would be one of the proposed or the one of the acceptable options under 111D if the EPA were to go ahead with this. It does raise, I think, some interesting kind of federalism concerns because, you know, while it's true that the states would be coming up with these implementation plans and presumably therefore taking on cap and trade voluntarily, there is an issue of coercion in the idea that states who are previously disinterested in greenhouse gas regulation are now going to be forced into doing something about it. I personally think that's kind of a problem when you consider how awkward it is, as I mentioned before, to consider greenhouse gas as one of the types of substances that 111D is designed to reach, as it's hardly comparable to some of the more discrete compounds that 111D goes after. So when you factor in the statutory stretch to reach existing stationary sources under 111D in the first place, with all this that I mentioned, it seems to undermine the notion that the Clean Air Act says, which is that air pollution control at its source is the primary responsibility of states and local governments. So that might raise a question about constitutional structure. But, I mean, Mark, do you have anything more specific on that?
I'd like to take cap and trade and carbon taxes separately. On the cap and trade side, assuming that they were authorized, and just assuming that for the sake of argument, EPA has done other cap and trade systems under the Clean Air Act without a constitutional challenge. I'm thinking now of the NOx-SIP call from the late 90s and the cap and trade program that resulted from that. The Clean Air Interstate Rule, which, while it was found unlawful, remains in effect. There have been no constitutional challenges. So I don't think that there would be a constitutional issue there. On the carbon tax side, on the carbon tax side, that would be an indirect tax that would raise a potential uniformity issue that I think is just a little beyond me.
Can I ask you, on the previous times they've enacted cap and trade for other noxious substances, or I should say criteria pollutants, was it done through a state implementation, or was that EPA going through a rulemaking and saying there shall be a national cap and trade on this pollutant?
Okay, that is a loaded question.
Not
from a technical. I know. From a technical perspective, under the Act, did EPA do it through SIPs? In all previous instances where EPA has enacted a cap and trade program under the Act, there has been at least a theoretical ability for a state to submit a state implementation plan that did not include the cap and trade aspect, but that got the required emission reductions in another way. Generally speaking, that alternative was, whether by design or by necessity, unpalatable, and there was a strong built-in preference for participation into the system. In the case of the most recent cap and trade program, the cross-state air pollution rule, which the D.C. Circuit recently vacated in its EME Homer decision, there arguably was no ability for a state to get out of that. It was, in many cases, implemented through an error finding in existing SIPs. So you might get some question there about whether a state could opt in or opt out. But generally, there has been some authority to get out of these from the state perspective if a state really wanted to.
Okay, so in short, I think what you're saying is if we did it for other noxious substances, we can do it for CO2, or meaning we, EPA, and that it's not a problem.
That's not what I'm saying. Assuming for the sake of argument that it's consistent with the statutory language of Clean Air Act Section 111D, EPA has done four primary trading programs under the Act: the NOx-SIP call, which was upheld, although no party specifically challenged the cap and trade mechanism there; the Clean Air Interstate Rule, which was found to be unlawful. The clean air mercury rule, which was vacated by the D.C. Circuit on grounds not related to program design, although the court didn't consider program design, and the cross-state air pollution rule, which was vacated in 2012 as being inconsistent with the Act. I think at this point, it's a very open question whether or not any trading program is lawful under the Clean Air Act. But, you know, if you get, you know, I took you, taking your original question to be a constitutional question, not a question of statutory design and regulatory program design.
It was, but you've added a lot more meat to the question, and I appreciate that. That's about all I got. Thanks very much.
Well, gentlemen, let me give each of you, we've got about as much as 8 minutes left. Let me give each of you a chance to wrap up as we conclude our call. Do you want to begin, Wilhon?
Sure, sure. So I would just emphasize that what we're really talking about here has a lot of different kind of policy implications, both the proper role of administrative agencies, question of deference, questions of separation of powers, as well as a very novel issue of statutory construction. One thing that's kind of discussed a bit more in the paper, but we didn't really mention on the call, is that there's actually a conflict between the language in the statutes at large, which is, you know, the actual law that prevails in a dispute with the U.S. Code, and then the language of the U.S. Code. So there's a lot of novelty within this argument, but that doesn't mean that the EPA has the ability to kind of contort ambiguity, vagueness, or even take advantage of a admittedly unusual legislative history to suit its regulatory aims. I'm reminded of a quote from a Supreme Court decision, Whitman versus American Trucking Association. This is from 2001, and I think I'll stop with this. It's a good place to end for me, at least. Congress does not alter the fundamental details of a regulatory scheme in vague terms or ancillary provisions. It does not, one might say, hide elephants in mouse holes. So in short, two decades of failed congressional attempts at cap and trade do not make it magically manifest in Section 111D. Mark?
Thanks, Will. And I'd like to conclude where I began. I mean, Massachusetts versus EPA is the law of the land, and EPA does have real questions about how it should be exercising its authority and exercising its discretion under the Act. And it calls for a rigorous and program-by-program consideration about whether or not regulating under a particular program is required and is lawful. And if there's not a program that fits, there's no necessarily reason why EPA must find a way to reach all types of sources. And to the extent that statutory programs are being used in situations where they aren't intended or where they are badly misfit, there's a larger constitutional and administrative state question about whether a statute primarily designed in 1970 and 1977 is the appropriate vehicle for addressing greenhouse gas emissions and addressing the effects of climate change, or whether or not, you know, there needs to be congressional action or other limiting doctrines in the courts.
This is Dean Reuter of the Federal Society. I want to thank both Mr. Will Hahn and Mr. Mark DeLaQuille for joining the call today. To our audience, I remind you that Mr. Hahn's white paper, Federal Society white paper on this topic, is available on our website. You can also find a link to it in the notice you received for today's call. Also reminding the audience, I invite you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be discussing the Supreme Court case, again, that's being argued on Monday, the Arizona voter ID law case. Until then, however, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.